to the basic shape of Grice's account and the way that Grice wants to use it to deal with some of the issues we've been considering. And as I say, Irina will be in charge of showing faults in this broad picture. So I'll start with a brief recap. Then I'm going to talk a bit about the idea of calculating implicatures. Say something very brief in passing about the distinction between conversational and conventional implicatures. Then I'll talk in a bit more detail about seeming differences between first-order logic and English, one in particular, and how the Gricean machinery might be exploited in order to explain away those seeming differences, to show that they're more apparent than real. And connected with that, I want to end by talking about what we can think of as some signs of implicature, some kind of bits of evidence you might appeal to argue that some broadly linguistic effect is a matter of implicature rather than a matter of what's stated or said, or a matter of the strict and literal meaning of some expressions. Okay, so the problem we're kind of struggling with is that there's good reason to think that the meanings of words make a stable or uniform contribution to sentence meaning, and that sentence meaning itself makes a stable, uniform contribution to determining what's said. Well, that's part of the point of learning the meanings of English words and sentences. It's so that it will put you in a position that you can kind of take a shortcut to figuring out what people speaking that language are saying to you on an occasion. So that's one side of the problem. The other side is that there seems to be good reason to think that the very same words can be used to convey a wide variety of different messages, as used from occasion to occasion. So there's a kind of tension here between the idea that it would be kind of pointless to have competence with a language if it didn't put one in a position more or less automatically to compute what people are saying to you by use of that language. On the other hand, that doesn't seem to be how things go. It seems as though, given what the words people have used in your presence, you've still got a bunch more work to do to figure out what message they're conveying to you on an occasion. And then the solution, or Grice's solution anyway, is to distinguish between what's strictly and literally said or stated, what's made fully articulate. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways of trying to put the idea. Distinguish all that from what's merely implicated, what's suggested, insinuated, or otherwise got across by the use of those words on that particular occasion. And then the idea is that what's strictly and literally said is determined more or less, like fully determined more or less, by stable sentence meaning in accord with the demands of compositionality. Right? So word meaning fixes sentence meaning, fixes what's strictly and literally said. By contrast, what's implicated is determined by what's said, together perhaps with the way it's said, the specific words used to say it, and perhaps intonation and the like, right, in cases of sarcasm and the like, together with very, very general principles governing rational communication. Principles that apply more or less any case of rational communication in any language. So on this view, communicative competence, right, the bunch of skills you have that enable you to figure out what's going on when folk talk to you, communicative competence consists of two main parts. First is what one knows by virtue of being a speaker of a particular natural language, say English, or English round here, right? Like, what is it, West Midlands? West Midlandish. Okay, perhaps. Okay, there's what one knows by virtue of being a speaker of a particular language, and that's the kind of thing you have to learn by exposure to talk in that language. It's the thing you have to come to acquire as a child in order to speak your native language, and it's the thing you struggle with when you try and learn to speak, say, Spanish or French or German or what have you. So this, the idea is, gives you a head start in figuring out what people mean, by enabling you easily to figure out what they're saying.
So that's one part of communicative competence.
And then the other part, kind of more general part, is what one knows by virtue of being a rational communicator. And this more general competence puts you in a position to derive other elements of speaker meaning, in particular the implicature carried by speakers saying what they do, on the basis of applying these general principles governing rational communication. So there's the stuff you know, say, by virtue of speaking English, and that's very local. That's helpful here, less helpful over there. And then there's your knowledge of general principles governing rational communication, and those apply absolutely everywhere. Okay? They might be what you exploit in order to figure out, in order to find your way into speaking Spanish, say. Suppose you're dumped in Spain, you're there for a long time, let's suppose, and you need to figure out what monolingual Spanish speakers are communicating to you. You might exploit general principles of rational communication to start trying to work out what the words mean. And you'd be able to do that because it's an absolutely general competence. It applies across the board, unlike the specific knowledge people have of local languages. Okay, so speaker meaning in general is a form of non-natural meaning. So it's to be accounted for by appeal to speakers' intentions, either reflexive intentions or otherwise open, overt intentions, as captured by some kind of multi-clause Gricean account. What's said and what's implicated are two species of speaker meaning, more generally. And then we have the idea that, at least plausibly, saying something, right, stating something, is a more basic action than implicating something. One implicates something typically by saying something. So just as I might acquire coffee by going to the cafe, ordering coffee, taking money out of my trousers or whatever and paying for coffee, right, I might do one thing by doing a bunch of other things. Similarly, the idea is I can implicate things or communicate things more generally by doing something first, by saying or stating something. So you get the idea that there's that implicating something is indirect. It's something one does by virtue of doing something else. You implicate something by virtue of saying or stating something. And perhaps by saying and stating something by use of particular words. Okay? So we get the idea that you'll sometimes see in the literature that implicating something is a kind of indirect speech act. It's a speech act performed, an act of speech performed by doing something else, merely saying something. Okay, and to terminate the recap, we reach the point where we got to the cooperative principle, which is the kind of overarching principle that Grice takes to govern rational communication. Right, so this principle and the maxims and sub-maxims that it governs and generates is supposed to be the core of your general purpose communicative competence. It's because you know or can figure out that the cooperative principle's in play that you have general purpose communicative competence that you can then slot together with your specific knowledge, say, of English, in order to figure out what messages are being conveyed to you, what's being said and what's being implicated in your presence. So the question then is, how does the cooperative principle help us to deal with the puzzle? In particular, the need we have to provide an account of what's conveyed, got across, given knowledge of meaning and background knowledge. Right, we know in broad terms what the idea is. The idea is that someone says something, states something, and thereby communicates something else. And the cooperative principle is supposed to help us figure out the machinery that mediates between those two elements, that takes you from what someone says to what they merely implicate. And then the core idea here is, this is Grice, to calculate a conversational implicature, to work out what the conversational implicature of some utterance is to calculate what has to be supposed in order to preserve the supposition that the cooperative principle is being observed. Right? It's what you have to suppose in order to preserve the more general supposition, the more general assumption that the person speaking to you is seeking to obey the cooperative principle.
Okay. The core idea is that a conversational implicature is a kind of assumption you need to make in order for it to be true that a speaker's sticking to that cooperative principle. What do you have to assume about them in order to think that they really are ultimately adhering to the cooperative principle? Let's take a very simple example, and a simplified account of that example. Here's an example from the film Fargo. Marge says, where is everybody? Lou says, well, it's cold, Margie. Okay. And now the question is, well, what's Lou communicating by saying it's cold? Right, minimally, it looks like what he said is simply that it's cold, but we naturally think he's thereby communicated more, and in particular, perhaps communicated an answer to Marge's question, where is everybody? Okay, so here, very kind of rough form is how the account would go, according to Grice, on the basis of appeal to the cooperative principle. So first, the idea is that there's reason to presume that Lou is being cooperative, right? He's not trying to buy out of the conversation. He's not trying to buy out of the shared aims of cooperative communication. Two, unless Lou thought that coldness were the reason why everybody's not here yet, Lou's contribution would violate maxims of quantity and relation, and so fail to be cooperative. Right? He wouldn't be saying enough in order to answer cooperatively Marge's question, and he wouldn't really be being relevant. Right? Mention of the temperature wouldn't be relevant unless Lou thought that coldness were the reason why everybody's not here yet. Third, Lou thinks and would expect Marge to realise, he thinks, that Marge can work out that unless Lou thought that coldness were the reason why no one was there, Lou's contribution would violate the maxims. So he wouldn't be being cooperative. Right? So we assume he's being cooperative. On the face of it, it looks like he isn't being cooperative. What do we need to assume about the circumstances to reinstate his being cooperative? And the idea is, in this case, we need to assume that Lou wants us to realise, he realises, that coldness is the reason everybody's not here yet. So when calculating implicatures, when engaging with what people say to us in general, we face two kinds of questions. Right. First, why have you produced precisely that utterance? What were the reasons for you producing exactly the form of words you did on this particular occasion? Why have you said that? What were your reasons? And the second question, kind of core of Grice's account, is that we ask ourselves how we can answer that first question in a way that treats you as adhering optimally to the cooperative principle and its maxims. Okay, that's the idea. So someone says something to you, these are the two kinds of questions you ask yourself. Why are they saying that? And how can I answer that question? How can I say why you're saying that in a way that makes you out to be reasonable? Okay? Not just going off on some mad tangent or whatever. So that's the basic shape of the story. We'll look at some slight tweaks as we progress. So now I'm going to say something very brief, almost in passing, about the distinction between conversational and conventional implicature. So the basic structure we have, according to Grice, is something like this. We have speaker meaning in general, and that divides up into what's stated and what's implicated, the implicature. Where what's stated is, as I've said, fixed more or less by the meanings of the sentence used, and what's implicated is determined by appeal to this kind of cooperative principle. But then according to Grice, implicature divides up into its own two species. on the one hand, conversational implicature, and on the other, conventional implicature. So the idea here is that conversational implicature is the kind of thing we've really been focusing on and thinking about to this point. Conversational implicatures have to be computable through the use of the cooperative principle and maxims on a particular occasion. Okay. They can vary from occasion to occasion, and knowing about them isn't any part of being competent with a particular form of words used to trigger the implicature. So the idea is that unless it's possible to calculate an implicature on an occasion, given reasonable assumptions about background knowledge and your ability to exploit the cooperative principle in order to figure out what assumptions need to be made about the speaker to make them cooperative, unless it's possible to do that, you don't have a case of conversational implicature. It has to always be possible to calculate the implicature in this sense, to work it out. So that's conversational implicature, but Grice doesn't think that exhausts the field of things that we get across without strictly and literally saying or stating them. So the other species is conventional implicatures. And Grice's idea here is that these may have a kind of ultimate explanation by appeal to the cooperative principle and maxims, but they've been made habitual or conventional in something like the way that literal meaning is habitual or conventional. So that any use of a form of words that carries this kind of implicature will carry that implicature. It won't vary from occasion to occasion in the way that conversational implicature can. It's built in to the meanings of the words, in effect, that they carry this particular implicature. Okay, and that's something that you'd ordinarily expect competent speakers of the language to know. Right? I mean, they'll know that using this bit of language carries a particular kind of message just by virtue of a feature of that piece of language. You won't have to go through the rigmarole of calculating or figuring out what the implicature is. Now, it's actually controversial whether there really are such things as conventional implicatures. And there's a good discussion of this in Ken Clark's conversational implicature paper. and even if there are, they're kind of relatively uninteresting, in part because the ultimate explanation for why they're in play will typically depend on an appeal to something like the cooperative principle and maxims. So the idea is that in the past, people used some ordinary expression of English in a way that ended up carrying conversational implicatures. But it turned out that became so regular that people used this expression in a way that carried this particular conversational implicature, that that implicature became bound up habitually or conventionally with the use of this expression. And when that happens, you get the idea of conventional implicature rather than merely conversational implicature. It might not even be possible to work out on a particular occasion what it might not be possible to calculate on a particular occasion this particular implicature. The only way of spotting this implicature might be through prior exposure to the specific conventions bound up with this particular language. Okay. I'm not going to talk about conventional implicature. I'm just, pointing out that there's a potential distinction here that Grice likes, that not everyone likes, that may figure in specific accounts of specific cases. I want to turn instead to thinking about seeming mismatches between first-order logic and English. In particular, one kind of mismatch that very often strikes people when they first come across the standard first-order logic treatment of the analogue of OR, disjunction in first-order logic. So consider an ordinary utterance of this sentence, My partner is in Oxford or in London. Okay, my partner's in Oxford or in London. Some people, perhaps many people, will judge that an utterance of that kind would be false if the utterer knows his partner's in Oxford. Okay? There's something wrong with saying, my partner's in Oxford or London, if you know that your partner's in Oxford. And that can give rise to the idea one would be speaking falsely. Similarly, suppose I say, you know, you ask me when my office hour is or when I'll be in my office, and I say I'll be in my office from 2 till 3 p.m. or I'll be in my office from 3 till 4 p.m. Unhelpfully enough, you might think. Right? When in fact I'll be in my office from 2 till 4, I'll be in throughout that time, and I know I will. Right? This might be a kind of trick. I want you to get confused, don't know whether to come in the first hour or the second hour, so you go and see someone else instead. Is what I've stated true? Is it perhaps false? Or is it in some other way inappropriate or problematic? Different people will have different judgments about these cases, but one judgment you might have is that what I've said is false. Okay, it's not true to say I'll be in my office from 2 till 3 or I'll be in my office from 3 till 4 when I'll be in my office from 2 till 3 and 3 till 4. Now, cases of this sort have suggested to some theorists and some beginning students of first-order logic that English or has an exclusive reading. Right? Sentences in which it's the main connective are false if more than one disjunct is true. Okay, and that's a mismatch with disjunction in first-order logic. Yeah.
Does or have the same meaning if it's used in a question as in a statement in English? Because when we ask a question such as, is it a boy or a girl, regarding a baby, and someone just says yes, it might... It seems we're asking for one of the disjuncts and not...
Well, I could ask you if you want coffee or biscuits, and that would still be useful.
Yeah, but if I just said yes...
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll say more about this because I haven't committed to saying that English or does have an exclusive reading. So it might be that the evidence you're appealing to there is just evidence that it doesn't always have an exclusive reading. Distinct question, more general question, is whether one wants to think that the content of a sentence is used in a question is going to be the same as the content of a sentence used in, say, an assertion claim. It's a very delicate question, very difficult to answer straightforwardly. There are good reasons for thinking it must, and that in general, you want the contents of expressions to be the same across various forces with which those sentences can be used in order to make sense of certain kind of logical transitions. Right? If you say, I don't know, did you have a boy? Did you have a boy? And that's a question. And I say, yes, I had a boy. Okay, now you want to know why that counts as an answer to that very question. Okay, more generally for any case of this sort. And now if one thinks that the meaning or the content of what was expressed across those cases is dramatically different because one was a question and one was an assertion, one will at least struggle to explain why we think there's a match in those cases. There's kind of generalisations of that point that will suggest to people that there must be a strong correlation between content across these cases. But I don't think it's actually a straightforward issue, and there's lots of controversy about this question. But for present purposes, I don't think it really matters. Okay, so at least some people, right, and perhaps you were amongst these people, and you confront the idea that in first-order logic, a disjunction's true in the cases where both sides of the disjunction are true, right? Many people think, oh, that's weird. That's not how it goes in English. At least there are cases in English where it looks like something's gone wrong, where you make use of a disjunction where both disjuncts turn out to be true. So there's some evidence there that or takes this kind of exclusive reading. But now there are cases that seem to pull in a different direction. Here's one again from friends. Monica says, "Hi, my friend here was taking down our Christmas lights and she fell off the balcony and may have broken her foot or ankle or something." And it seems, at least to me, it seems clear that what Monica says there would be true even if Rachel had broken both her foot and her ankle. Right? It'd be weird for the nurse to pull her up on those grounds. So now we're at a kind of point we've got to in thinking about "and," where there seem to be cases of the use of "or" that at least suggest an exclusive reading, and there seem to be cases of the use of "or" that don't seem to suggest an exclusive reading. And that might suggest to us the hypothesis that "or" in English is ambiguous. So, minimally, if that's right, if there are these cases of the use of "or" that take an inclusive reading, that allow that an "or" claim can be true when both disjuncts are true, if that's right, we can't explain the inappropriateness of my initial claim, the one we were worried about and thought led to the idea that "or" was exclusive. We can't explain the inappropriateness of that claim by appeal to the idea that English "or" only takes the exclusive reading. We've got evidence that at least sometimes it takes the inclusive reading. So now, right, as I've said, we might try out the idea that English "or" is ambiguous. Sometimes it takes an exclusive reading and sometimes it takes an inclusive reading. Okay? And that's not too bad, right? That's two-way ambiguity. It's not unheard of in English. So that might be okay. Nonetheless, it's not a very nice explanation for at least two reasons. The first reason is just that it multiplies senses or meanings. So it multiplies the number of particular specific things a speaker has to learn in order to become competent with this piece of English or these pieces of English. Right? Instead of just learning one thing in order to acquire competence with "or," you have to learn two things. Just as you do with "bank," say, you have to learn both meanings of "bank." And that's not very nice. It'd be nice if that weren't a commitment of our view. Of course, that's not decisive. We know that there are ambiguous expressions in natural language. So, you know, that could just be how things are. But second, and kind of connected, the ambiguity view fails fully to explain the inappropriateness of the target claim we started with. "I'll be in my office from 1 till 2 or 2 till 3, what have you. It doesn't explain that, because to get such an explanation, we need to explain why we seem compelled to give some claims the exclusive reading. Okay. What we need to explain is why what I said was felt to be inappropriate, not merely ambiguous. Right? Why is it that on confrontation with the weird disjunction claim that you want to give an exclusive reading to, we don't just think, "Oh, he could mean either the exclusive reading or the inclusive reading"? What compels us to give it, in this case, the exclusive reading, given the openness of these readings? Yeah.
But when you say the target claim, do you mean the sentence that has the "or" in it?
Mm. Yeah. So the claim started with, the claim that "I'll be in my office from 2 till 3 or 3 till 4. When you find out I'm going to be there for the whole 2 hours, you think something's gone wrong there. And not merely that I wasn't sufficiently clear that what I said was ambiguous. The ambiguity appeal on its own doesn't explain that. Right? It doesn't explain why we automatically give the expression its exclusive reading in that case and not in some other cases. Again, that's not decisive, because there might be some explanation for why that is. It's just the challenge to someone wanting to present this ambiguity claim. They need to say more in order to make their explanation convincing. Okay, so there are some worries about a straight ambiguity view. But there's a slightly more nuanced and more subtle view to be considered. And Grice presents it in the following way. Grice says, and this isn't presenting his own view, this is presenting a more nuanced version of the view he wants to try and undermine. The fact that it would be inappropriate to say, my wife is either in Oxford or in London, when I know perfectly well that she's in Oxford, has led to the idea that it's part of the meaning of or of either or, to convey that the speaker is ignorant of the truth values of the particular disjuncts. And that's supposed to be carried by the meaning of the expression or. So if I say, I'll be in my office from 2 till 3 or 3 till 4, the idea is that's only correct and appropriate if I don't know which of those disjuncts is going to be affected. Okay. So given that I know I'll be there for the whole period, something's gone wrong here and we trigger the inappropriateness judgment. Now, I think it's pretty clear that this offers a more plausible hypothesis about the meaning of the English word or than the minimal ambiguity account. So on this hypothesis, the felt inappropriateness comes not from or being exclusive or inclusive, whatever, but from or requiring that utterers not know which disjunct is true. So in cases where they do know, we get the inappropriateness judgment. So slightly more carefully, the idea is that A or B is true just when, first up, A disjunction B is true, according to its first order logic truth table, and two, there's a non-truth functional reason for believing A or B. That is a reason which is not straightforwardly a reason for believing that A is true, and which is not straightforwardly a reason for believing that B is true. Okay. So given what you know about A disjunction B in first order logic, you know that the canonical grounds for asserting A disjunction B will either be A, which leads immediately to A disjunction B, or B, which leads immediately to A disjunction B. Those would be the canonical grounds, those would be the truth functional grounds for asserting A disjunction B. The idea here is that that's precisely not how A or B works in English. In order for A or B in English to be assertable, you have to have grounds other than grounds for thinking that A is true or grounds for thinking that B is true. Right? Got general grounds for thinking that my wife or partner is either going to be in Oxford or in London. No grounds for thinking she's in London, no grounds for thinking she's in Oxford, just that she'll be in one or the other. She told me she's going shopping. Now, obviously, London and Oxford are the only places anyone would go shopping, so I have grounds for thinking she's in one of those two places, but no grounds for thinking she's in one, no grounds for thinking she's in the other. So, and Grice calls this the strong sense of or in English. So this account is proposed as an account of the meaning of the English disjunction or. So construed, it's supported just to the extent that it fits what we know about what's strictly and literally stated by the use of the disjunction. Right? Because given that we have this assumption that what's strictly and literally stated is determined by meaning, we can use facts about what's strictly and literally stated to derive conclusions about meaning. Right? Some sentence is used to strictly and literally state two things. That's evidence that that sentence is ambiguous. It has at least two meanings, for example. However, I hope it's obvious by now, following Grice, we've distinguished within the totality of what a speaker means by use of a disjunction what the speaker strictly and literally states and what the speaker merely implicates. So evidence that English or is used to produce different messages isn't yet evidence that it's used to say or state different things. So isn't yet evidence that the meaning of or carries these different effects. So given that distinction, we've actually got to consider at least two hypotheses about the relevant effects. Okay, the first hypothesis is that the strong reading of the disjunction in the English or affects what's stated and so traces to the literal or conventional meaning of that disjunction. That's one hypothesis. Hypothesis two, the strong reading of the disjunction affects only what's implicated. So it's to be explained by appeal to the cooperative principle, general knowledge about rational communication, rather than by appeal to the literal meaning of the expression or. So it's to be explained by these general knowledge about rational communication rather than specific knowledge about a specific feature of English. Okay, those are the two hypotheses. One hypothesis, this is something you have to learn when you learn English. Another hypothesis, this is something that any speaker of any language, any rational communicator, is in a position to know just by virtue of being a rational communicator. And here, give a flavour of the second hypothesis, we might naturally hypothesise that if a speaker knew which disjunct were true, then the maxim of quantity would require them to give that information rather than to use the far less informative disjunction. Okay? So by using the disjunction, by using or, speakers naturally implicate that they don't know which disjunct is true. Right? Again, if I say I'll be in my room from 2 till 3, or I'll be in my room from 3 till 4, and I know that I'll be there for one or the other or both, then I'm flouting the maxim of quantity. I haven't said as much as I'm in a position to say, you know, in addressing this query about when I'll be in my office. Okay? So you know that. So seeing that I've used the disjunction, you're in a position to figure out that if I'm being cooperative, if I'm not trying to trick you, then I don't know which of those hours I'll be in my office. I'm telling you as much as I can, given the information at my disposal. Okay, so those are our two hypotheses. And then the question is, which hypothesis should we favour? First hypothesis, it's a matter of meaning. Second hypothesis, it's a matter of the application of the cooperative principle. And here, right, there's this specific question about or, but then there are going to be versions of this question that arise with respect to lots and lots of bits of natural language where we seem to have similar kinds of behaviour. I want to go through very briefly some of the marks or signs that Grice wants to appeal to in order to kind of drive through one or another treatment of particular examples. Right? Wait, signs for Grice that we either have a case of implicature here or a case of ambiguity or some nuanced special meaning of particular expressions of English. So the first and in a way most important sign of implicature is a kind of general methodological principle which Grice calls modified Occam's razor, and which has come to be known in the literature as Grice's razor. And this just says that senses are not to be multiplied beyond necessity. So, in effect, if you can avoid attributing an ambiguity to a piece of natural language, do so. And then, of course, making use of the cooperative principle will be one way of doing that. So the idea here, in a bit more detail, is something like this, right? The way we've set things up, we know that we need absolutely general principles governing rational communication. We know that they're in play and available to us on reflection. We know how to figure out what that people are aiming to be cooperative in certain ways, and what that entails, what follows from people being cooperative. So we know we need general principles governing rational communication, so we get them for free with respect to any particular case. Right? We know we need those across the board, so we don't have to add anything to our overarching machinery in order to have those to apply to a particular case. We're not multiplying any bits of explanatory machinery because we need that stuff anyway. So second, the very same general principles can do explanatory work for us over a wide range of cases. Okay? And that's good. That's what you want from a good explanation. By contrast, appealing to multiple senses or multiple clause rules of use for particular expressions has only a particular application. It only explains the behaviour of this particular piece of language, say, or in English. It doesn't generalise to other cases in the way that appeal to the general rational principles does. So, all else being equal, appeal to the general principles is preferable to appeal to a specific multiplication of meanings. See how that goes with a specific example. Suppose that it turns out that both A or B and if A, then B are subject to some kind of non-truth conditional grounds condition. Suppose that's how things look when we think about various cases in which these expressions are used. One option would be to write this non-truth functional grounds condition into our accounts of individual expression meanings. So we write it in once for or, and again for if then, or if. Okay. But that would involve counting the very same condition twice. That would involve counting the same condition twice. By contrast, if we can explain both cases by appeal to a single general principle that we need anyway for an array of other cases, then we can provide a simpler and more general overall account of what's going on in these cases. Hence, to that extent, Rice's razor looks very plausible. Right? If the option is to write the same condition into, you know, 2 or 22 different accounts of meanings for different linguistic items, versus just making appeal to very general principles of rational communication one needs everywhere, favour the latter course. And the idea is that that will favour the second hypothesis, the hypothesis that all has, say, the simple meaning given in first-order logic, and we explain seeming deviations from that by appeal to the cooperative principle. So that's one kind of piece of evidence in favour of the second hypothesis. It's the kind of evidence that would figure more generally in defending a Gricean treatment of particular cases over some kind of ambiguity treatment, some kind of nuanced account of the meaning of a particular expression. A second kind of sign, which is in a way more specific, is the idea of cancellability. So here the idea is that where a particular condition of some kind is carried by an expression meaning, it's carried by the particular meaning of some expression, then that condition ought to be in place whenever the expression occurs. It ought to have the force of a kind of entailment of what's said by the use of the expression. Okay. By contrast, where a condition's in place as an aspect of merely conversational implicature, it's typically going to be cancellable. Whether it occurs on an occasion will depend on further features of the surrounding circumstance. So an implicature that arises in some particular cases can be prevented very often by explicit or implicit information to the effect that the speaker doesn't intend to pass over that implicature. So here's a kind of case just to see how that's supposed to go. As I say, he's a bachelor, but I don't mean to suggest that he's unmarried. Okay? Something's gone wrong there. It's entailed by someone's being a bachelor, that they're unmarried. So if I say he's a bachelor but he's not unmarried, I've just said something inconsistent. Okay. So in that case, one can't cancel the entailment from bachelor that the person's unmarried by saying he's unmarried. That would just lead to this kind of inconsistency. By contrast, although the issues here are slightly delicate, if I write a reference for X that says he has neat handwriting, remember very often that will carry the message that he's terrible at philosophy, say. But if I say he has neat handwriting, but I don't mean to suggest that he's not an excellent philosopher, that looks fine. It looks like I've thereby cancelled what would otherwise have been a message to the effect that this person's not a good philosopher. Right? And similarly for other cases of implicature. Right? You can get a case where if you just say one thing, what you say will naturally carry a particular implicature, but you can simply cancel that implicature by saying I don't intend it, or what have you. Perhaps by appeal to other features of the circumstance. And then there's some plausibility to the claim that non-truth functional conditional grounds condition with respect to or is cancellable. I'll be in my office from 2 till 3 or from 3 till 4. Indeed, I'll be there from 2 till 3. Looks okay. Okay, looks odd. It's too prolix, but it looks to be an acceptable. It's not incoherent, not inconsistent. However, there's a potential difficulty here, since ambiguity will often give rise to at least an analogue of cancellability. So one can often make plain which of two or more meanings an expression one intends to exploit by explicitly ruling out the other readings. So I can say something like, he was in the grip of a vice, and I don't mean the kind one uses for woodwork. Right? So even though being in the grip of a vice, given the intended meaning, entails something, it is something one uses for woodwork, I can cancel that by triggering recognition that I meant the other meaning. So it's not clear that cancellability on its own can be used as a test case for whether we have ambiguity or implicature. It's more of a kind of sign that needs to be used carefully in conjunction with other signs. Okay, better stop there. So, said on Thursday, Arena will be stepping up and explaining why none of this works. But for the time being, we can all rest happy in our belief that this is the best account to be given. Thanks very much.